I'm Catherine Harity, the CEO of the Australian Music Centre, and it's with great pleasure I welcome you all to the Peggy Glanville Hicks Address for 2021. The AMC would like to acknowledge First Nations people as the traditional owners and sovereign custodians of the lands on which we work and live. We recognise their continuing connection to country and their respective nations across this continent, and we pay respects to their elders, past and present. We also celebrate the unique and inspiring creativity and songlines of the world's oldest living culture, and give thanks for the immeasurable influence First Nations people continue to have over the music and the art we all enjoy. Since March 2020, it's been an uncertain time, but indeed the pursuit of art has always been challenging and uncertain. I want to acknowledge our brave, wonderful Australian creators and the inspiration and comfort their music gives us all. I want to thank our members who continue to support the organisation and the work our team undertakes every day with great pride. The AMC is a one-of-a-kind Australian not-for-profit advocating for all in the art music community. We hope to continue to do this and more as we traverse a new, transformed creative space. And moving forward does not mean letting go of our history. We will build on our legacy of commitment to our vital, living Australian music collection and the artists that create it. We also want to acknowledge our wonderful collaboration with ABC Classic and Jazz for November's Oz Music Month. Through the month, Australian music will be celebrated and played online and on air more than ever before. Now, it's my great pleasure to introduce Marshall Maguire, the chair of the AMC, to say a few words.
Thanks, Kath, and welcome everybody to this great event. Thank you especially to Kath and the entire Australian Music Centre team for all the effort to get this online today to you. The Peggy Glanville Hicks Address was founded way back in 1999 by the New Music Network, and was recently inaugurated to celebrate the opening of the studio at the Sydney Opera House. And we always wanted it to be a forum for provocative ideas, to challenge the status quo. And the list of enviable speakers that we've had over the past 20 odd years is adorned today by three more creative, provocative, and unique artists. I think it's fair to say that more than ever, there's a need now for the voice of the artist, the creative spirit, to be part of the national discourse, exploring ideas and experiences about who we are, where we've come from, and where we're heading as a vibrant, influential, imaginative, and creative nation. More than ever after these years, we need to support all of those artists who seek to express and observe and challenge the complex world in which we live. And it's in that sense that we invite you to engage today with our guest speakers in this year's address. So please welcome Zella, Bree, and Sia for the Peggy Glanville Hicks Address 2021, and over to Vanessa Hughes from ABC Classic.
Thanks, Marshall. Hello. I am coming to you from the ABC Classic studio on Gadigal land. It's in this little box here with a construction site through the window there that every day I have the absolute honour to broadcast the most inspiring, incredible and exciting Australian music. This is land that, has been singing and talking for tens of thousands of years, and we are very much only just starting to listen. Sovereignty was never ceded, and I pay my respects to First Nations people here today and on all the lands in which we meet today around Australia and beyond. Welcome to the Peggy Glanville Hicks Address / Panel for 2021. I am honoured to be here. You are learning today how three art music makers make their music. That's what it's all about today. Sia Ahmad, Zella Margosyan, and Bree Van Rijk, each of them occupies a singular place in this little art music scene of ours. They're very different. They've got very different things to say. They work differently. And like any musicians of any kind, have managed to survive. the last 18 months. Not to mention the black hole of arts funding in this country, $100 million gutted in 2015. In May, the Treasurer in his budget delivery speech didn't mention the arts once. There's no longer an arts communications department federally. Our wonderful art music scene and the entire arts industry sits alongside water grid planning and road safety and freight supply chains. That is where our art scene sits in the eyes of our government. But these artists and so many others are still making and inspiring, and they're going to show you how they compose, how they play, and what it's like for them to be making music right now. They're each going to talk to you, and then we're going to have a conversation about it. A reminder to you, if you want to keep our Auslan interpreters, that's Steve Waddell, you can see him on the screen now, just right-click on his video frame and click pin, and he'll stay front and center for you. We are recording today, so everyone behave. We're going to start with Sia Ahmad and this incredible world of sound Sia creates, a DIY punk autodidact, a curator and facilitator, dialed in from Ngunnawal country in Canberra today. You will delightedly fall down a rabbit hole listening to Sia's music. You can hear her voice, electronics, guitar, sounds that you can imagine and can't imagine in her creations. Her latest album, Facade, has only just come out, and so much of what she has made, she's made with others. Sia is a true collaborator. She is seemingly played everywhere and with everyone, like the Australian Art Orchestra, where she also directs. She is also on the board of Girls Rock Canberra. Sia Ahmad.
Thank you, Vanessa. Before I start, I'd like to acknowledge the traditional owners of the land on which I work and live on, the Ngunnawal people, as well as the Ngambri, Ngarrigu, and others who have traded on, travelled through and connected with this land and continue to do so. I recognise all custodians of country throughout all lands, waters and territories. I pay my respects to the elders, past, present and emerging, and remind all that sovereignty was never ceded. This address is a great opportunity to remind ourselves as artists and audience that we create in parallel to an important Indigenous cultural narrative that is as old as humanity has been on this continent and speaks of diverse stories important to all the nations across these lands. I was a teenage kid in a Belconnen bedroom listening to the radio and poring over music magazines. I didn't have the aptitude for learning an instrument, but I had become hooked on ideas. Not theories, but a feeling on what music could be if made on instinct alone and with a nervous energy. I read about garage bands and loft gatherings. I read about positive mental attitude from Rasta punks. I read about A Thief of Fire, Typical Girls and the Buffalo Stance. I read about the moment Raga Drone took hold of rock and roll. I remember hearing Brimful of Asher on the radio and finding out they were a band that shared the same skin colour as me, making references to Bollywood singers to dance-worthy funk. I remember the first time I heard the album Free Jazz and being in awe of the expressive freedom, hearing the different musical colours throughout the beautiful chaos. I would listen to everything, read about everything, and dream about these stories as mythic tales. I would dream about where my place in this could be. In being asked to speak as part of this year's Peggy Glanville Hicks address alongside Brianne Zeller, I've been looking at why I do what I do and why I am where I am. Even before COVID lockdowns took hold, I had taken a step back from the notion of career to retrace my steps and arrive back at those formative discoveries and innocent dreams to guide me once again through my practice as a maker, facilitator, and mentor. My creative life is 100% tied to the DIY punk ethos I grew up with, and it is intrinsic to how I carry myself through life too. I left that childhood bedroom to graft all over the continent, then the world in a way that fits me best. I've spent years making the music that speaks closest to my heart, and through this process, I've been blessed to find myself sitting within a community that finds equal space for myself, those who I look up to, and those still finding their feet in the creative world, all of whom I can call a friend. Without punk rock, I wouldn't have found those like me and share a worldview that celebrates creativity in all its glories, flaws, and everything in between. Without punk rock, I wouldn't be reminded, day in, day out, to find ways to break the system, then rebuild the structures better, so there's a chance to remain self-reliant and sustainable when things are at their lowest ebb. Without punk rock, I wouldn't keep thinking of ways to make creativity accessible to one and all, how to remove barriers so identity and social status were of no concern. Through all the lockdowns and restrictions, I've been lucky to continue my work in the art sector with stability and be supported to keep creating music. But more importantly, I've been able to use my privileged position to keep working with those who make up my community, to support them the best I can through performance opportunities, professional development conversations, or simple messages of reassurance that things will be better soon and better for the future in general. I certainly didn't think it at the time, but I do think my teenage self would be stoked at knowing that I help creativity thrive for the community and that I'm still as invested as I was all those years ago in how this community lives and breathes.
Thank you, Sia Ahmad. We're going to be zipping back to Ngunnawal country in a few minutes after a detour to Wallumedegal country in Sydney's north, where pianist and composer Zella Margosyan writes and plays her music. Zella studied classical piano from the age of four, but for many, many moons, she's been head over heels for jazz, her own kind of jazz, a lot of it with her own ARIA-nominated Zella Margosyan quintets. You hear jazz rhythms, you hear jazz harmonies in their music. You also hear bits of classical and folk songs from Armenia and beyond. Zella was the AMC's inaugural artist in residence in 2019. She's been commissioned by the ABC. Her next album, The Road, comes out in February. Zella Margosyan.
Greetings. I am dialing in from Wallumedegal land. I acknowledge the traditional custodians of the land on which I work and live, and recognize their continuing connection to land, water, and community. I pay respect to elders past, present, and emerging. I would like to thank the Australian Music Centre for granting me this wonderful opportunity, together with two exceptional artists, Sia Ahmad and Brie Van Rijk, to take part in Peggy Granville Hicks' address, presented, as you can see, in a special format this year. I feel extremely humbled, and I hope my modest address will spark some positivity during these uncertain times. It now has been almost 20 months since the onset of the COVID-19 pandemic, and the impact of the restrictive circumstances it created in people's lives is felt nationwide, and the livelihood of many has been compromised, especially evident in the music industry, which was one of the sectors affected the most. Challenging times necessitate shifting perspectives to cope and find new ways to endure hardship. I admire the dedication of artists in the music community who, when live music came to a halt and numerous productions were canceled, devoted their time to create petitions and reach out to the government to ask for more support for the art sector. Live stream events, online collaborations, remote teaching all became part of the new norm, as adapting is key to survival. But when human interaction is restricted and limited, the true essence behind why we make music is lost. Each performance with my band, Zella Margosyan Quintet, is different because of the energy in the room. And each interaction with an audience is unique, which translates into the music. Consequently, with the absence of a live audience, it was very challenging to find the energy to spark that special dynamism, which is almost only created in a live setting. The band and I also had plans on releasing a second album when the pandemic hit. It was difficult to face an uncertain future and not be able to plan ahead, which compromised the momentum of productivity and being present. Last year also, in August, amidst the global pandemic, I witnessed my beloved Beirut, where I was born and raised, experience one of the most horrific explosions ever recorded in modern history. A month later, a part of my ancestral homeland, Artsakh, spiraled into a gruesome war. I was heavily burdened by extreme emotions of sadness, and I shared the sorrow of the Lebanese and Armenian people. However, through those difficult emotional times, I gained an important perspective. This, compounded by the COVID-19 situation globally, gave me a new outlook to deal with issues that I was facing. And through that realization, I felt an immense gratitude, a gratitude of living in a country where I feel safe, where I never have to search for clean water, face food shortages, and have access to a functioning health system, to name a few. This gave me the strength to continue and create. I realized that it wasn't only a matter of endurance, but a time to reconnect with our passions behind our impulses to create, to appreciate what we took for granted, and strengthen the relationships with musicians fostered during the challenging times. The future might seem uncertain for a while to come. However, I can see a light ahead. Witnessing the perseverance of musicians during these challenging times, their creativity with presenting their music content online, music teachers devising interesting ways to present their lessons remotely, and festival and venue directors going to extremes to keep serving music to the community and supporting artists as much as possible, is proof that there is a collective will to keep the music alive. It's a well-known fact that we have a big challenge to tackle, a lack of proper government funding for the arts. However, on the other hand, we should embrace what we already have, which makes the creative community blossom: diversity. Diversity is an essential part in any community and is a great binding force in the creative sphere of the arts. Specifically, in the music sphere, diversity brings about unique relationships through music. Exchanging ideas and learning from one another's backgrounds, personal stories, cultural heritage, and musical traditions bring about distinct collaborations and interesting projects. Contribution creates connection, and connection creates a network of support, which is essential during uncertain times, such as the one we are experiencing right now. Speaking of my own experience, my band is an indication of that fact. The mere existence of the quintet is a testament that cultural diversity can result in a beautiful, harmonious outcome. I am grateful for the opportunity I had after moving to Australia to explore all my cultural and musical identities and create something that not only represents me, but opens the door to similar stories to unfold and continue the traditions of cultural diversity on which the land we live on has embraced for thousands of years. Touching back upon gratitude, I would like to say thank you to each and every individual in the music industry who accepted me, who cared about me, taught me, supported me, and appreciated my music. That's why I consider myself lucky that I am a visitor on this exceptional land, my third home, and I am thankful and grateful for the beauty it offers me. It is our mission through music to spread love, unity, and healing, especially to those who need it the most. Thank you.
Thanks, Ella Margosyan. We'll catch you in conversation after Bree Van Rijk, percussionist who's also dialed in from Ngunnawal country. Bree is a drummer, percussionist, composer, and sound artist. If you caught her opera last year, Invisible Bird, you'll know how warm and joyous and funny her music can be. She has played with everyone from Gurumul to the Australian Chamber Orchestra. She was the composer in residence in 2019 at the Canberra International Music Festival. And her music has been commissioned by festivals, orchestras, galleries, and another enormous pile of impressive names, Bree Van Rijk.
Thank you, Vanessa, for that lovely introduction, and thanks everyone for being here and for listening and sharing. Thanks to Sia and Zella. It's lovely to hear. So it's been lovely to connect with you throughout this process and to hear what you have to say. Like Sia, I'm also here on Ngunnawal country today, which is where I grew up. I'm at my friend Jess Green's house. I don't play double bass. I don't play guitar very well, but I think that they look quite pretty. This is Ngunnawal country is also where I grew up, and it's where I've had so many of my formative musical experiences. As Sia said, I didn't realise you're also from Belconnen. I grew up in the suburb, in the area called Belconnen, listening to punk rock in my bedroom, playing in the garage. I play with my friend Jess Green and Zoe Hauptmann, who many of you will know, in the garage when we were 16, 17, playing with the Canberra Youth Orchestra, playing in punk rock bands at all ages shows, driving around in my parents' car listening to Sonic Youth. And actually, I drove from my parents' house here this morning and I listened to Sonic Youth again. And I was really inspired when we've had a couple of chats before these sessions, just hearing Sia talk about how important punk rock has been to her. And it certainly has been to me. And I was thinking about what I would wear today and I thought, I'm going to wear my Sonic Youth jumper. It's not what I would normally wear, probably to a classical, you know, I wouldn't wear it on stage in a classical gig. Well, maybe I wouldn't used to, but maybe I will now. In thinking about preparing for this talk and what I wanted to say, I thought about many different things. And one thing that came to mind was an online event, one of the few online events that I did actually go to during this last 18 months or so, which was something that my friend Claire Cooper was part of. Claire is a beautiful harp player and improviser, and also like a futurist designer or something at the University of Technology, ETS, or Sydney, I can't remember. Anyway, Claire was part of the Zoom event, which was also with a lot of artists from Ireland and all around the world, who did a lot of community-based art. And they were sharing their art, and Claire, when it came around to her, she said, I'm really torn about what to do because I'm a control freak, but I also love improvisation. And she was trying to decide whether she would read the speech that she'd written beforehand or whether she would just play the harp. And I was like, please, please, please play the harp. And she did. But I really loved that idea of, she did, and it was beautiful to hear. It was actually one of the most moving things I've seen during the pandemic, especially online. Just to have this spontaneous performance. What I will say is a combination of being somewhat controlled and wanting to explain myself properly and also just loving to freestyle it. When I got here and I spoke to my friend Jess, as I said, about this talk, and she asked if there was a theme about it, and I explained there sort of was, and she was like, oh, well, I don't want to hear what anyone has to say about COVID, but I have had some profound thoughts during this time. And I think that we all have, and I know I certainly have. And if I think back to the start of the pandemic, there were some major events that were very profound for me. As Vanessa said, my opera, The Invisible Bird, was supposed to premiere last year, but it got cancelled. It was probably one of the first events to get cancelled, certainly in Australia. It was supposed to be in late March. But fortunately, the Sydney Chamber Opera, who were premiering in it, had already arranged the documentation to happen. So we were actually able to get through and film it. And the cast did an amazing job, and the whole crew did an amazing job of filming it on basically what would have been the first day of Tech Week. So a week out from the opening. And as a result of that, like, it was really devastating at the time. I worked for a long time on that and I was looking forward to seeing it. But in the end, it's actually been shown, it's been watched probably over 9,000 times now. So we wouldn't have had that kind of audience reach before. So that's really exciting. And the film turned out beautifully. So that was a positive thing. I also thought about very early on in the pandemic, I finally got around to finishing an album that I've been working on since I got a grant to do it when I basically got a grant from the Australia Council, and then I found out I was pregnant. And my daughter, just to say, my daughter is almost 5, and the album will probably be coming out just after her 5th birthday. But I finally got time to finish that album during the start of the pandemic. And ironically, it's an album really about being together. It's called Superclusters, and it's got all these moving parts from all these improvised performances from many of my closest friends and musical colleagues over the years. We had all these recording sessions with bringing people together, recording in the room together, and making a really spontaneous and live and empathetic sort of responses to the musical compositions I'd presented. And then the irony was that I was editing them all on my own, and I couldn't see any of these people for months and years, and we certainly couldn't perform it. And then thinking about where we are now, I guess I'm hoping to perform again soon, maybe in a couple of weeks. But it's been a really difficult time for everybody. And when I think about what I want to do with music, it's what I want to do with myself and my life. And it's, and like, I need to be able to nourish myself and others. And I'm trying to find more and more ways to do that through music, rather than just plowing ahead with music and trying to nourish myself in other ways. I saw a really beautiful blog post recently on an Instagram account that I really enjoy by from Adrienne Marie Brown, who is a writer of a book called We Will Not Cancel Us and Other Dreams of Transformative Justice. And she's also written a book called Pleasure Activism, The Politics of Feeling Good. And she has podcasts and a very funny Instagram, which is like, sometimes it'll be cat memes and sometimes it'll be zombie memes and sometimes it'll be a beautiful blog post like this, which is called Not Busy, Focused, Not Busy, Full. So this is Adrienne Marie Brown. This is a poem or a reset. You keep telling me, you know, I am busy, but, and then you ask me for something and I want to know, I want you to know I am not busy. No, with all of these boundaries, I have space to write, to take care of my body, to hold my loves tightly in my many, many hands, so we can somehow make it through the rest of our lives. And that's the opening of the blog post, and I would love to read the whole thing, but I won't. But I think that that question is, for me, like, how will we make it through the rest of our lives? And that's what I've been certainly thinking about a lot. And this time has sort of shown me that I miss people, and I miss making sound with and for people. And I want to be slow and sustainable, and I don't want to be busy anymore. The final lines of Adrienne's blog post are, I hope to never be busy again. I owe this quiet breath to my grandmother. I am creating at an astounding rate, and some of it I even write down. Some moments I get so still, I can sense how it is all connected, and that tissue is love. And I know my love could never be wasted or too small a contribution. I say yes when love leads. I say yes when there's enough time to do it well. And sometimes even then I am not there because life showed me another way to love and it was irresistible. Everything that happens between that opening and closing part of the blog is beautiful. And I will put it in the chat at some point, a link to that post. But I think this idea of what is irresistible to me what is she finding that's more irresistible than doing the writing or doing everything else? And I thought about what's been irresistible to me recently. And also the other side of that is like what I will not resist. So I've been thinking and I've realized that I will not resist being aware of my privilege. I will not resist acknowledging it. And I will not resist finding ways to use my heart and mind and ears and hands and time and creativity in order to divest and disperse my privilege is irresistible to me. The past 18 months have been really hard for musicians and artists, but we're used to it being hard. Like when this all started, I said to some friends, I was like, well, everyone's freaking out like they've lost their job, but we never even have jobs anyway, or we're just making it up. And even if you do get a gig, you know, we don't tend to earn a whole lot of money. So I think that musicians are actually fairly well placed to deal with this situation because we are very resilient. If you've made it this far, if you're 43 like I am and you've lived most of your life in Sydney as a musician, you can cop it for a while. But for many other people, life is non-stop hard and it's non-stop isolated and it's non-stop uncertain. Particularly in this country, we know that's the case for Aboriginal people, you know, in many places, in many parts of the country, that they continue to be far more affected by poverty, by ill health, by problems from violence and systemic violence and racism and all of these things that's all nonstop. And so I think about that a lot. I think about my place. I'm studying in the Composing Women program at the Sydney Conservatory of Music, and I'm extremely privileged to be there for so many reasons. I'm sponsored on a government scholarship. My tuition is covered as part of that. I'm extremely privileged because I have amazing access to the brilliant mind and heart of Lisa Lim, who has been so inspiring and such an amazing leader. And part of the program there, it's in this Composing Women program, myself and a colleague were given the opportunity to go to assist on a research trip with Georgia Curran in Yindamu. And Georgia Curran's work works with the Walpri women around Yindamu, which is out of Alice Springs, documenting and helping them to make use and document and make available the Yawuyu songs. And through that process, I met some people who run a young women's music program at PAW Media in Yindamu. And that's a new program that Grace Marshall and Ben Green up there have been setting up, where they realise there's not many Walpri people, young Walpri people working at PAW in the sound and music departments. So they wanted to encourage the girls to work in there by maybe learning to play some instruments and get involved in a band program. And so I've been trying to support them there. One of the things that happened through that was I helped them to organise a crowd fundraising campaign, which raised $18,000 to buy musical instruments for those young women. The program is called Piriji Kanda Kanda, which means strong women in Walpri. And I want to have an ongoing connection with that. Well, I do have an ongoing connection. And what the pandemic has shown us is that we, like it or not, we can Zoom in, and there are great benefits to that. And one of the things that I want to do ongoing with that is to provide one-on-one lessons for young women in remote communities with musicians like myself and my friends, and hopefully sponsored from crowdfunding. Something else that I will not resist doing is I will not resist continuing the act of opening my eyes and responding to the inequality and discrimination I see, calling out and making positive action towards the destruction of sexist, misogynistic, racist, trans-hating, gay-hating systems and behaviour is irresistible to me. So again, with the CW, the Composing Women program, when I started there, I had a 10-month-old baby, and my awareness of the world has changed so much since having her, and imagining what her life will be like and how much may or may not change during her lifetime. And when I first walked into the conservatorium, I went to the library, and the first thing I saw was these three busts of these three pale, lifeless European men staring me down from the entrance to the library, which is such a beautiful place of learning and knowledge storing and sharing. And everyone told me it was Beethoven, Bach and Brahms. It's actually Beethoven, Liszt and Wagner. But I looked around and I realised there was no women. There was two more busts. There was another Beethoven and there's no Sculthorpe. Oh, sorry, there's Sculthorpe. So there's five busts, there's two Beethoven and no women. So I decided to make a campaign to change that representation. And again, I worked very closely with Lisa Lim and my other colleagues in the Composing Women program. We came together and we thought about who we would like to see represented. We decided as a starting point that it would be Deborah Cheatham, that's who we would like to see represented. And we approached Deborah Cheatham, who many of you will know is an amazing opera singer, a composer, an academic, and activist. She led the opening of the Mardi Gras parade at one point a few years ago. She's an absolute legend and hero. And she was willing to be busted in this form. So earlier this year, we managed in between lockdowns to install the bust of Deborah Cheatham, which was made by my friend, very generously made by my friend, sculptor Anna Willey. And so now when you walk into the library, the first thing that people see is this bust of Deborah Cheatham. And I'm very happy to be opening my eyes to that view when hopefully we can get back into the library again. What I will also not do is I will not resist listening to and trusting myself. And part of this is trusting my knowing that most of the systems and philosophies that our culture is based on are damaging, patronising, unequal and unjust, and they need to be re-evaluated and changed. I think it's great that AMC has taken a change to this format, to the format of this address this time, and I'm thankful that they make a courageous decision to just say, hey, we've always done this, let's do something else, let's open it up to three people and then we get a wider range of perspectives. I think that's really beautiful thinking. And for me, I think a lot about just basically turning everything upside down. I just feel like if anyone's I just feel like basically I sort of just blame the patriarchy for almost everything. And I just think, what if we just like shifted it all upside down and thought of it the other way around? And somehow for me, this has ended up in my most valued and nourishing creative experience from the past few years now, is playing a plank of wood, which is a 2x4 plank of wood. It's not even one, it's just whatever one I happen to have lying around. It's not special. You can get one from Bunnings if you're interested. You can also just probably find one lying around in the back lane, or you could go to the reverse garbage or the Bower, or just wait for council to pick up and pick up a plank of wood. I play it with sticks because I know how to do that, and I know that wood on wood makes a good sound. It's an unspace for me. So it's often an unloved, like a discarded piece of leftover material, a remnant from something else. It's generic raw material. It's non-specifically musical, but it contains a huge array of naturally occurring harmonics, as every sounding object does. It's the exact opposite of a Stradivarius, but it's, to me, it's equally rich and valid. And I can use my hands and sticks to play it, but the actual techniques of doing so are completely different and changed. So it's very different to any other instrument, percussion instrument I've learned formally before. The practice that I do on it is slow. It's led by my body and by listening. So my practice doing that is to sit down at the instrument, to wait, to listen, to feel what my body, my hands want to do, and to start to make a sound. And then just continual process of waiting, listening, and moving. And I think that that's really how I see myself moving through the world now, is to be aware of what's happening, to listen to what's happening, and to find a way to move through it. And then I find a new possibility on this plank of wood, something, I chase a particular harmonic, or I chase a particular sound, and then I do that again. And it's renewing. It's a very simple process, but that's how I want to move forward. And I think it's a beautiful slow process, and it's a meditative process that I want to use to affect and to colour all my work from now on. As I said, hopefully I will play this irresistible plank of wood sometime soon. And actually, I'm hoping that it will be at the Peggy Glanville Hicks house in a few weeks' time for a small audience, playing with my friend who's the current resident, Aviva Ondine. So thanks to Peggy for donating her house, and maybe I could see some of you there playing a plank of wood. Back to you, Vanessa.
Thanks, Bree. What an awesome chance to hear from all three of you about how you tick and how you make your music. I'm going to dive right in with some more questions for you. You've all touched on this idea of slow. Strangely enough, given that you all make such different kinds of music, and you all inhabit these different pockets of art music, none of you seem particularly enthused by the spectre of online live stream performance. Sia, you mentioned before when you were talking about how, you know, your idea of slowing down and exploring a different way of practicing was actually upon you before the pandemic. Can you unpack that a little bit? Why did you want to slow down, and where were you trying to get to with that?
Yeah, look, it wasn't intentional. I think for me, I'd come off a year of putting out two records, one of which was like, sorry, no, I should really clarify this. So it was just a big year. There's a lot of touring. There was two records. There was the work that I did called A Modesty with the Australian Art Orchestra, which was actually part of basically a triptych, including the album Quiver and another installation work called Broken Binary Brown, which all explored identity. So very deeply personal, touching on gender, race, and religion, this holy trinity of identity, as I kind of call it. And so it was really big. And I went into, that was 2018, I went into 2019, basically thinking, well, what's next? And looking at it from, as I kind of keep saying, the career perspective, like what does it mean to, what's going to happen next? What's going to kind of keep my career moving? And I kind of had a crisis of confidence based around, you know, not really feeling generally connected to the ideas that I was tinkering with in my mind. And you know, I was lucky to be working with an organization here, a non-oral country called You Are Here, who do career development, run a career development program every year called Cahoots. And I was just involved with that. And I proposed an idea. And basically I got to the first session. I was like, I'm not in love with this idea. I don't know what I'm doing here. I don't know what I want to do. And so I kind of worked, they actually helped me through the process of unpicking like what it means to be an artist who doesn't have anything to do right now, doesn't have an artistic idea in mind. And you know, that year my practice became like reconnecting with my love of cooking, which had slowly dissipated over the few years, you know, the years after having children, and even before that, to be honest. And you know, it was really interesting winding back, and really, as I said in my keynote, just the idea of looking at what made me want to be a musician in the first place, what made me think that I might have a creative bone in my body. And those instincts were, you know, being in a garage, you know, listening to the radio. I mean, for me, I would say I'm a musician second. I'm a music fan first and foremost. Like you can see, I've got all my CDs, which I've been collecting since years, and there's vinyl and books on music, you know, past the laptop screen as well. And like for me, that's part of being an autodidact, actually sinking your teeth into those ideas and stories, those myths, as I said. And that really is what inspires me. And so actually reconnecting with that, you know, through to the end of 2019, and we were surrounded here in Ngunnawal country by bushfires, and it really impacted us here, impacted our life, impacted you know, work life, but impacted my life as a parent, something I hadn't had to figure out. And, you know, there was definitely points throughout that season where, you know, I kind of felt like my heart, you know, in crisis, because I didn't know how to protect my children from something like this. And there was an uncertainty around that in a way that, you know, I'd seen COVID slowly trickling through the European continent and whatever as well. So that felt more tangible, weirdly enough, than the uncertainty of bushfires. But before that, I'd kind of resolved that whatever happens, happens. It's instinctual again. It's coming from a place of, you know, genuine, you know, inspiration and feeling. And then lo and behold, I was, you know, I didn't start making music, but I ended up writing a whole lot of poetry, poems or whatever, inspired by, it ended up being a piece on my record from last year called A Body Full of Tears. The piece is called Blown Out, Trace Out. And it was inspired by watching the Warwick Thornton film. Oh my God, I've totally forgotten the name of it, but we Don't Need a Map is the name of the documentary. And it's about using the stars and talking about the Southern Cross and how it's been appropriated by Anglo culture, but what its meaning is to Indigenous cultures. And I was kind of like looking at it from this point of view, like what happens if you can't see your guiding stars, your guiding lights at a time, and like we couldn't during bushfires. And and that became a community kind of anti-choir project, which was again really nice to then connect with community, my musical community, my creative community, in an organic way to work together again. And so it was just these ideas that's happened organically, and it's the first time in a very long time, like the works I talked about from 2018, they came from a very personal place, and a lot of it was quite therapeutic, but a lot of it was quite deliberate, whereas the work that I made then from bushfire season through to lockdowns 1 and 2 is like, it's been very just instinctive and really slow. And it was so great to have those chats earlier on with Bri and Zella around slowness in our practice, because we certainly hadn't talked about it. And it's a revelation that we're all kind of sitting in the same space and trying to find a way to utilize time where there is time. But yeah, look, it wasn't by design, but I love that I've been able to embrace slowness and, you know, like take all those steps back.
And interesting that it has changed the stories you're telling as well. Zella, I wonder for you, you talked before about losing momentum with that album release. Has losing the opportunity to work together and perform live, has that forced you into resetting your speed? And have you been able to turn it into anything positive?
Yes, definitely. I think I shouldn't say the lockdown forced, because I think sometimes things happen And there's a reason behind it. I'm not saying COVID has a reason behind it, but for every one of us, if we take it as sort of like an experience and a lesson that we can learn from, as Bri and Sia, I was very busy just before COVID. And part of the reason for that is when I moved to Australia and after years, when I decided to transition from just playing classical music to studying jazz harmony and just sort of discovering myself, is that I put a lot of pressure on myself. I was always criticizing myself, not satisfied with the knowledge that I was receiving, because I felt like there's such a big gap in my knowledge, especially with the jazz improvisation and the new mindset, that whatever I did felt not enough. And I pushed myself. But now when I think about it, is that I had to do it, because in a short period of time, I had to get back on my feet. Although I was a musician, but I just didn't feel back then that I was a whole, because part of me always wanted to learn about the jazz genre. Although I don't consider myself a jazz musician and I'm still learning, yet, but I might become, I might be able to play jazz standards and all of that repertoire once very naturally. But I did it, I studied it because I needed the knowledge to incorporate in my compositions, which organically happened. So when the lockdown hit and life changed a little bit, like Sia, for example, when I was home and I was cooking a meal, I wasn't rushing, and that was so much fun, because I'm always in a rush. If I have to go somewhere, I have 10 minutes to get ready in opposed to half an hour to get ready. So these little things, I embrace them all. And at the beginning, when the album, the project timeline was altered, I was upset. But then I said, why should I be upset? Because it's not the end of the world. This might be a chance for me to reconsider some things, to learn, to practice. And although there were no live performances, of course, it was very strange at the beginning, because when you don't have live performances, your practice tends to change. Because when you have a performance, there's sort of like a goal, but there's this energy that you're preparing for that event. And the band rehearsals are different, because there is something ahead. But that also taught me to try to maintain that. So when I am practicing, there's always a little goal behind it. So if I'm doing this, this is to improve, for example, this thing in my practice, and always think that there is something in the future and I'm preparing for that. But in that time, lots of good things happened too. I was productive in so many other ways. I had time to prepare the album design, the album content, whatever there is for the new record label, at my own pace. Otherwise, I would have rushed it. I had time to reevaluate some things, think about new projects. Although I didn't create, I wasn't in the mind space to create new music. I did some art collages, which I always love to do. I had time for that. And also just focusing on some language, French language. I started improving my French. So lots of things that in the future, I know that it will translate in the music. And the comfort that I found in slowness will translate in future music, I'm pretty sure.
I mean, I'm generally loving the positive vibes here after the last 18 months. I guess now that you've found you're all much happier and incredibly productive going slow in a different way, Bri, can you speak to whether people can afford to go this slow? You know, a few of us have touched on, you know, the lack of arts funding. If you're not generating content to be consumed and paid for at a huge pace, how can you afford to be an artist in Australia?
I think even if you are generating content to be consumed, you maybe still can't afford to be an artist anywhere. But also, I mean, you're talking about affording something financially, and I think you actually just personally, I can't afford my mental health to keep continuing at the kind of pace that I was before. And like, I have had a lot of thoughts, and there's a lot of positives that I see coming out of this period, but I have also been extremely depressed, and it's been a really difficult time. So for me, it's like, I can't afford to, I don't have the time to afford to do things that I don't really want to do anymore. And it's not even financial, it's just that I know that I have to put trust in the fact that if I'm working towards things that I really believe in, that it, like Zella was saying, that this will come in, it'll have positive effects down the track. I guess again, it's quite, like, we had a little bit of government support financially, but I think it's more about questioning, how can we afford to sustain our minds and hearts? Because ultimately we could all just go and get a job at Woolworths if we really needed to, we could get some job, or I don't do any teaching of small kids or something at the moment. So I know that I could always pick up other related things if it came to it.
Sia, you spoke about how supportive your community has been, your little music community has been over the years, and how many people you mentor and have mentored you. I wonder, with the broader leaders of our government not coming to the party in terms of supporting the arts, are there ways in which the art music scene might better support itself? How you might, you guys all come from very different pockets of art music in Australia. Is there any crossover? How can you guys better support each other, do you think?
Yeah, absolutely. I think it's a big question. It's a very important question, though. And, like I said, I come from this world where, I read about people sharing, touring networks or pooling money together to put out records. And it definitely seemed like a mythic tale when I read about them, but they sounded so nice and actually so fanciful in a very flippant way that, I just kind of took it to heart. So, for me, I've always been so lucky that, people took a punt on me writing to them on MySpace or writing a cold call email and then giving me a gig without hearing any of my music. And all these little, chances people took on me, that's so heartwarming. That's where the friendships start. That's where the relationships begin. Then when you live that life, you only want to give that back to your peers, to, like I said, to those who are still finding their feet. And, for me, I talked about breaking the system and then building it back up again. And it's all about, you want to do things the way that feel best or feel equitable in a really relatable way. And for me, I'm working within the system still. I call myself an accidental bureaucrat. I didn't plan on working in arts admin. I really did just want to play punk rock. But, there's certain things happen and you take these paths. And conversely, I only have the skill sets to work in the arts industry as an arts worker because of being on the road and schlepping and grafting myself, and is the only skill set I have. So you want to be able to share that knowledge and wealth of experience with others. And so when it comes to sustainability, the irony is that I've had very little luck with funding in my whole life. I got more funding during the COVID period through local government and APRA. And, there was some other things which I don't quite remember where the money came from, but the money came in. And then even in, being in ACT, we were lucky to not be a hotspot for a long period of time. I even managed to go on tour for 2 weeks against my better judgment, but I still did it because the opportunities were there and it allowed me to do what I wanted to do. And, so you want to think that, you want to think, well, what's the good fight? How hard does that fight have to be? And where does the money come from? And, it's very hard. I work as a curator and a programmer, and what I want to do most of all is provide great working conditions for my fellow artists through that. And I'm always trying to understand where the budget is coming from. How much budget do we have to work with? But it's also like, how far deep do we have to go into like finding the appropriate, philanthropic support, going right to the heart of people and their, interest in our, creativity. And it's not just for us, like we're here, like I said, we're working parallel to the Indigenous cultural history of this continent too. And, how does that money get to, people working in that sphere properly and acknowledging that as well? Like, it's such a big conversation to have. I wish there was a way that we didn't have to rely on government supports, from federal to local to, state and territory or whatever. I wish there was a way to make it equitable. Maybe it is about small stakes. Like you said, Bree, we could all go work at Coles and Woolworths and whatever. And so many people I know did that for years, where they worked a night shift and it gave them more money, and then they could do the night shift Monday to Wednesday, Monday to Thursday, and gigs at Friday and Saturday. And it was, it's a service, it's a necessary kind of income stream, but it also meant there was less pressure on these people because, they could check out at work and just do what they needed to do for their job, and it didn't nullify their creative mind as well. So, I would love to think there was an easier way of doing it. I don't have the answers. I wish I did. And if I did, I would activate them so quickly and so fast. But I'd love to think that there are philanthropists out there who, people with money who are actually just as keen in breaking the system and acknowledging that the arts and culture is so important to society and doesn't need a system to be part of to begin with.
Zella, I wonder how supported you've felt by artists and leaders of your own musical sphere, and what has that support looked like?
I'm very grateful. I've received a lot of support. I remember when I joined the con to study the jazz course, that's when doors opened and I met lots of incredible mentors. I specifically would like to mention the Young Women's Jazz Workshop that I joined in 2012, and I had just started learning jazz, and that workshop was a stepping stone for me and also an experience to see how it is to play in a jazz setting, and let alone with women and with women mentors. My first mentor was Zoe Hauptmann, and she's a key person in my life because she gave me a chance to perform when I formed the band. And it was sort of like a chain reaction. So that was the first one. And then it just happened that people liked it and we started performing. So people like Zoe Hauptmann, for example, for me, and there are multiple of Zoe Hauptmanns in the community I know, which I'm grateful for. At the con, all the knowledge that I received from mentors, they were all encouraging. They could see that I come from a classical background, and they could have just easily, they could have told me, oh, it will take years for you to become what you should become to be accepted as a jazz musician. But no one said that to me. I guess it's the nature also of mentorship that you have to encourage. And yes, I am very, very grateful for the emotional support and all the, the mentorship that I received. But when it comes to funding, obviously it has been difficult for us, as many, all of the musicians around. And I think that's one of the hurdles that we have, just to, we as artists have to push ourselves. We have to hustle to sell tickets at shows. That's one of the, I'm the manager of my band. I mean, till now I can't afford to have an agent or a manager to do the job for me. So I do that. And at the same time, I feel like, why do I have to make sure that people know about my show, that I have to be active on social media all the time, just because I don't want my band to receive insignificant money after a show, because we put a lot of effort as all musicians. But that proves that the music scene in Australia is so, there's so much potential that musicians play for nothing because they love music. And Yes, I wish, as Sia said, we didn't have to just rely on government funding. Sometimes I think, yes, as Sia mentioned, that's a good point about the philanthropist. If there's a committee that puts together ideas, or for example, I feel like on I don't watch TV that much, but there's if there was a program or a show, and people have been talking about this on social media, artists, to have segments that, where people can see what this sector of the music is doing, because no one knows about the music unless you're a music lover and art music lover, and you go and you search on social media and see what's at the opera house, what's at City Recital Hall, what in the venues, they know. But if otherwise, none of the people would know about Sia's album, for example, or mine or Bree's, unless they're in the niche, in the small niche.
Bree, I wonder if you can explain to me, as a non-punk rock aficionado, I'm sort of an outside fan in theory, but I'll admit I don't know that much about it. How does this intersect your work? You and Sia have both talked quite a bit about punk rock. So what's that all about for you?
Punk rock and music that stems from punk rock is the music that I most often listen to. So I would say that it intersects my music in that way, because I literally driving around. I mean, I take punk rock. I don't know what Sia's definition is. I feel like it's quite undefinable. It wouldn't be very punk to define punk rock. But what I love, the things I love about it is, like a lot of the really famous and very popular punk rock bands weren't like trained musicians, and there's exactly this huge tradition of punk rock bands being art school dropouts. And I remember when I was going to the School of Music in Canberra, it was next to the School of Art, and I was sort of, in my mind, I was like, I'm studying classical music and I study jazz as well. I was like, but I really just want to be a rock and roll drummer. So maybe I need to go to art school and then drop out. And then maybe that's how I, like, but obviously I'm not a famous punk rock drummer yet. But it's very raw. The energy is really powerful, and that, you know, it's politically strong a lot of the time, not always. So the roots come from the kind of expression, musical expression and artistic expression, is not this from a trained system. So it's not from studying your cantata, your scales and doing all the Bach inventions or whatever. Thankfully, and like, I love that. That's what's the sound is so amazing. I mean, I love the sound also of primary school children and beginner players. And I did a project a few years ago called Minor Works, where I commissioned pieces for primary school bands, because it just sounds incredible when you see a trumpet player, like, it's like absolutely every core of her being was going into making every single sound, and wouldn't even always work. But when it did, it's glorious. And so I've always been drawn to that, and I've always kind of, been on both sides. But I guess more and more now, I like to think that it's coming together. So I have a project called Massive Band, which is a 100-piece rock and roll band of women and girls, basically. And it's actually like an orchestra, because I grew up playing in orchestras, and I love that sound of massed groups. But it's punk rock because anyone can play in Massive Band. There's so many people, you could literally not even tune your guitar or have it plugged in, and you can still be in the band. So punk rock to me is more about the energy and the spirit, and it's not about precision, and it's about release, and it's not about this kind of formal presentation, and it's very open and powerful to me in that way.
Sia, how about for you, punk rock?
Yeah, look, I'd follow on and say, you know, it's always been about attitude over ability. For me in particular, like I said, you know, the attitude came from reading and just kind of all that stuff. So you kind of think, well, I'll just give it a good hot go and see what this mess is and just like roll with it. And, you know, I did that when I was 12, and I did that when I was 18, and I did that. I'm doing it when I'm like in my 30s now. And, you know, it's fun and game. It should stay fun and games. And it's funny because I say punk rock, and what I love even more so about punk rock, like Bree said, it's not really definable. You can't, like, I think what is tried to be defined as punk rock maybe isn't, you know, still honestly punk rock, because there's more things tethering it down. And, you know, one of my favorite books is Rip It Up and Start Again by Simon Reynolds, which is about the post-punk era. So after the Sex Pistols and the formation of the Clash. And what I love about that tome, you know, it's kind of like, I look at it as like a Bible, if you want to look in like that religious kind of way, like the idea that you could talk about hip hop, you could talk about early hip hop, you could talk about dance music, you could talk about, you know, bands like The Slits, so funky racket, guitar punk, without real chops. But then you could also, like, there's this funny thing where the notion of post-punk in 2021, people still think it's The Cure and Joy Division, but post-punk as a whole could be Public Enemy, it could be Nina Cherry, it could be Joy Division and The Cure, it can be Depeche Mode, it can be New Order, it can be anything. It can be anything. And the thing that, you know, I think, you know, one of the reasons why I'm here talking about art music is because I discovered bands like Sonic Youth. And through Sonic Youth, I discovered Cornelis Cardew and Pauline Oliveros when they decided to do a record of 20th century contemporary classical music with guitars and mallet percussions and all kinds of things. And I wouldn't be improvising if I didn't hear the punk band, The X from the Netherlands. And I wouldn't hear, you know, the improvising music of ICP and Han Benning. And, you know, I wouldn't even be delving into like Ethiopian music without that band. So, you know, it for me, punk rock's, you know, the best kind of gateway drug, because, you know, you're, everyone who's involved is, I would love to think, very open-minded and actually looking to just expand their sound, world of sound. And, you know, take the attitudes on from, you know, their peers and so forth. And it's always exciting. I think, you know, there's endless creativity, and the idea when you don't have anything tethering you, it is just straight up, you know, straight up fun. And, you know, there's, you know, silence can be punk rock. You know, I think that's what I'd take, you know, people think of punk rock as big noise, but, you know, big silence, just as punk rock.
We are running over time, sadly. I'm going to have to edge us towards the finish line here. I wonder, Zella, how different you feel creating in your industry compared to how you felt 10 years ago. Has the world around you changed, your musical sphere itself, or have you changed within it?
Yes, for me, it has definitely changed, because I moved here 14 years ago. So 10 years ago for me was my start. So it was my start. And I feel like I have developed a lot and learned a lot, still have a lot to learn, obviously. But for me in my career, obviously, things have changed, because I have gained the sort of like the confidence to do what I would like to do in my life as a musician. And I am grateful that whatever happened and what I created happened in Australia, because I think my music wouldn't have sounded as it does now if I were elsewhere. And that is because of the beautiful connections and the beautiful people I met. It was like a blank slate for me, because I come from different backgrounds. I grew up in Lebanon, and I'm of Armenian heritage, and I lived in Armenia, studied music in Armenia. So when I came to Australia and decided to start composing, obviously by the support of Judy Bailey, who encouraged me the most to start doing that, I felt like this is a blank slate, and these are the things that I am, and it's time for me to put them together and present them, because the energy here that I felt in specifically Sydney, because I moved here, it allowed me to do that. And also the love and support of everyone who appreciated what I did made it come true.
So your any final thoughts on this, about how you or your sphere has changed in 10 years?
I think, you know, whatever it is, it's changing constantly and forever. I would love to say, you know, it's interesting to hear, you know, Zella talk about, you know, kind of finding a way to start wrapping it up into, you know, a narrative to be put out there. You know, like I said, I think certain elements of my work has touched upon really personal things and then broader things. I would say, you know, I'm more aware of my personal identity than I was 10 years ago. And, you know, certainly like through a musical perspective, you know, starting this sphere of like just wanting to make a, you know, three chord racket in the punk rock style, I also discovered, you know, these certain bands within this realm also took from Indian raga. And so that's, you know, really core to my actual cultural being. It seeps into the music that I listen to unconsciously through my mum's cassette tapes growing up. And so, like, for me, musical life is all about the raga. It might not seem like that. And that journey continues, and how that, you know, how I then disseminate that into the public realm and have a platform like I'm talking about it now. I'm privileged to have this platform. And that's part of, you know, part of the chain, you know, the evolution or the changes or whatever that happens, you know. If I'm here in 10 years' time, what that conversation might be, may still have the same common threads, but I'm sure there'll be a lot more like life lessons to add to the mixer as well.
Bree, finally, any thoughts from you about that comparison, 10 years and 10 years ago and now?
I think I'm listening to more Sonic Youth now than I was 10 years ago, but probably equivalent amount to what I was 20 or 25 years ago. And like Sia said, it's changed, it's changing, and it's always changing. I certainly was performing a lot more 10 years ago, not because of a pandemic, but because I've focused a lot more on composition in the last 10 years. And I've learned that being a composer can be very, very lonely. I spent quite a lot of time just on my computer or with a notepad with no one else around. So like I said, you know, I miss people and I miss playing with people. So I hope that the next 10 years will allow more of that. But also, you know, I've got a small kid I want to spend a lot of time with. And I hope that I can find, moving forward some way to continue what I can do as much work as I can, but I hope that that's less work. And I hope that I don't have to be as busy as I have been for the last 10 years, for the next 10 years. And yeah, that's up to me, I guess.
Well, Bree Van Rijk, Sia Ahmad, Zella Margosyan, thank you so much for being so generous, sharing so much about your own creative practice and your lives in music. It's been a real treat to learn about it all.
Thanks, Vanessa.
Thanks, Vanessa. Thank you so much for facilitating.
My absolute honour. Thank you also to our Auslan interpreters, Amber Richardson, Stephen Waddell. Thank you so much for being here and listening in. Sorry we couldn't get to some of those fabulous questions. We've just run plumb out of time. The recording of this will be online soon enough. Check the AMC website. They've also got other fabulous events that might tickle your fancy. I hope you have a really fabulous afternoon and that next time we'll all be seeing you in person. See you later.
Thank you. Bye.